The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. On this edition of Century of Lies, we continue our look at opioids, addiction, treatment, and recovery. The National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine held a workshop not long ago on medication-assisted treatment for opioid dependence. We're going to hear portions of that workshop now. First, let's hear from Dr. Helena Hansen. She has both an MD and a PhD, and is an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the New York University School of Medicine.
So I'm going to Very briefly, tried to present some of my research as, first of all, a board-certified addiction psychiatrist still working at Bellevue in their outpatient chemical dependency program, and where I've been for over a decade. Also as a cultural anthropologist studying the social and cultural context of the current crisis and what led us here. Three major points. The apparently universal nature of the current crisis is the product of specific ethnic marketing of opioids and targeting of drug regulation to white consumers. Second, the impact of the opioid crisis on whites opens a window of opportunity to address the social determinants of health, but only if we directly address racial inequalities. And then third, in order to see population benefits from addiction medications, we have to foster social and structural change. And that's where I think the panels from yesterday really anticipated this discussion. So my research, let's see if I can change slides. Okay, so my research actually was prompted by my direct clinical observation of the pattern captured in this really early CSAT study. And that we continue to see today in most parts of the country. According to the congressional testimony leading to Data 2000, which legalized office-based treatment of buprenorphine, buprenorphine was introduced to meet the needs of, quote-unquote, a new kind of addict, one that was, quote, suburban and, quote, not typically associated with the term addiction, so implicitly white. Deregulation of buprenorphine and the marketing and media surrounding it, which was coded as white, and these are just some images from the manufacturer's website. These were intended to destigmatize opioids and addiction treatment. But addiction has long been enmeshed with race in our American policy. A century ago, racial imagery was used to build support for narcotic prohibition. Later, racialized images of heroin justified the war on drugs under Nixon in 1971, and then racialized symbolism of crack cocaine reinvigorated the drug war in the 1980s to 90s in the midst of record unemployment in black and brown inner cities, prompting racially disparate law enforcement and mass incarceration instead of a public outcry over the tragedy of drug-related deaths. At the same time, as historian David Hirschberg shows, there's been a separate track of legal protected narcotics for use for middle-class whites for over a century, and it has long been lethal. Overdose among largely middle-class white women from barbiturates in post-World War II era rivaled opioid overdose deaths today. Later, benzodiazepines like Valium were marketed as mother's little helper to suburban white middle-class markets. And our current opioid crisis was fueled by targeting marketing of OxyContin and other newly patented opioids to predominantly white, rural, and suburban areas for a large new market of moderate pain, people with moderate pain, like lower back pain, that traditionally had been, where opioids had traditionally been restricted to post-surgical pain and cancer pain in their use. So they were marketed in populations whose race did not trigger regulatory surveillance due to their assumed lower risk of addiction. And this led to non-medical opioid use in suburbs and small towns previously isolated from port city-oriented heroin trade, and after restrictions on prescribed opioid supplies through prescription drug monitoring programs and other new opioid formulations that were difficult to inject or snort were introduced to the market, this brought heroin to suburban and small town markets. And that's where these two images that I'd flashed earlier come into play, the new face of addiction. And then, as you know, fentanyl accelerated multiple overlapping opioid epidemics. Black middle-aged men are now showing the fastest growth in overdose deaths. Native Americans show twice the overdose deaths as whites, but the epidemic is still seen as disproportionately affecting whites. So I'm going to go forward to this. Okay, this is probably a study that's very well known to all of you. So this perception of the opioid crisis as affecting whites was made explicit when two economists sounded the alarm of population-level decline in life expectancy, specifically white life expectancy, largely due to opioid overdose deaths. And they coined the term deaths of despair, referring to the post-industrial decline of the white working class in the Rust Belt, and its blame for opioid use, overdose deaths, and suicide as the social fabric disintegrated in these areas through unemployment. Because the focus is on whites, the logic of social determinants of addiction can finally be heard in drug policy, yet the same argument could have been made for the black working class that also progressed from industrial divestment and unemployment to opioid deaths decades earlier. So in our era of neuroscientific understandings of addiction physiology, it's tempting to forego attention to social determinants in our longstanding search for magic bullets in order for medications to have population effects, though. This is really my argument. The social and health systems in which they're used has to be foregrounded. So let's take France, which is often held up as a success story of buprenorphine maintenance as overdose prevention. In France, the opioid overdose rate dropped 80% in the first 7 years after buprenorphine's introduction into primary care. It was billed not as a stigma-reducing agent for a white middle-class market, but actually a public health intervention to stem overdose and HIV transmission in low-income, largely immigrant heroin-injecting communities. In a country with universal health care and a robust social safety net, and I have to underscore that, universal health care, robust social safety net. Very different context. So contrast this with the US, where the overdose rates more than doubled in the first 10 years after buprenorphine's approval for office-based use. The public health potential of buprenorphine is limited by our race and class segregated healthcare system, which orphans patients that have patchy insurance coverage and tenuous access to prescribers. So the bottom line is that we have to intervene on social structures, race and class-based inequalities, in order to see public health impact of medications for addiction. Thank you.
That was Professor Helena Hansen, MD, PhD, from the Department of Psychiatry at the New York University School of Medicine. She was speaking at a workshop on medication-assisted treatment that was held by the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Now, let's hear from Dr. Josiah Rich. He has an MD and a master's in public health, and he's professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University.
Dr. Kumar mentioned being a part of the elephant. I always realize I'm holding on to the tail when I'm near the elephant. I'm going to talk about, tell the story of... MAT and corrections in Rhode Island, and hopefully that'll translate into a larger discussion. After completing my training in infectious disease and HIV, I moved to Rhode Island in 1994 in the throes of the AIDS epidemic. Rhode Island was unusual in that more than half of the AIDS cases were related to injection drug use, and that was related to a law outlawing syringes. During the 90s, a third of the HIV cases in the state were diagnosed in the Department of Corrections. So I started going out there on a weekly basis, and I tell my students I've been behind bars every week for the last 24 years, but I've been released from behind bars every week for the last 24 years. Went about setting up model programs, and I should mention that Rhode Island is both a combined prison and a jail, which is... A few states have that. But model program to diagnose the disease, start treatment, and link to treatment in the community, test partners. But, you know, HIV is far, you know, less than 1% of the population out there. But as I'm out there, I started looking and seeing, well, there's a lot more diseases. I mean, half the people or more have a mental illness, half have an addiction issue. So why not do the same thing for other diseases? So started working over a decade ago, almost two decades ago, on, well, hey, we have methadone. Why not treat opioid use disorder in the same way? Diagnose it, start treatment, link to treatment in the community. Then I ran into a lot of resistance. And I figured the problem is not enough evidence. So I set about establishing the evidence base, applying for grants and writing papers and moving forward. And I had this epiphany in about 2015, and I just realized, you know, in spite of all this work that I had done, I hadn't really budged the dial. You know, in Rhode Island, if you were on methadone, you would be continued on methadone for a few days when I first got there. It was a five-day detox, 50, 40, 30, 20, 10, and done, which is inhumane. But that is much better than neighboring Massachusetts, where you get zero. And over the years that evolved, we were able to start people on the dose that they came in on, and then we were able to push that out a week, and then we were able to push it out even further. But anyhow, in 2015, under the advice of a colleague and friend, Josh Sharfstein, the governor set up a task force to address the opioid epidemic, overdose epidemic, and I was fortunate enough to be one of the expert advisors, along with Tracy Green and others. We were given 90 days to develop a plan. We developed a four-point plan. The key point was treatment, and we basically said, you know, Rhode Island has about 1 million population. We have about 20,000 people that we think would benefit from getting onto MAT, and we should see where those people touch the systems, identify them, and get them onto treatment, and at the same time expand treatment capacity. And of course, they touch in the entire medical system, in hospitals and clinics and emergency rooms, but also in the criminal justice system, in police and courts, prison and jail. After jail in community corrections, probation and parole. So the governor said, well, that's great. That's a great plan. Where should I put my resources? And we said, you should put them into corrections, because that's where the people with the most advanced disease. You know, people become desperate, they resort to stealing, they resort to getting involved in the drug trade and the sex trade, and all of those activities get them caught up in the criminal justice system. There's also this situation where they're taken off of opiates or reduced their use dramatically, and their tolerance goes down, and so they're released at a time when their tolerance is low, and at time of maximal stress and triggers, and they relapse, and they're set up to overdose and die. So the governor allocated $2 million. I spoke to the director of the Department of Corrections around that time, and he said, Jody, you know, you've worked long and hard in our system, and you've really, you know, my staff is starting to come around about this methadone stuff. You've done some really good work, but they're not ready for this Suboxone, buprenorphine. You know, they're not ready for that. And I said, well, director, with all due respect, it doesn't matter, because the governor's going to tell you to do this, and you're going to tell your staff to do that, and if your staff wants to keep their job and you want to keep your job, you're going to do it. And he was sort of taken aback, but really that was critical, because it set the a tone, a hierarchical tone, to make it happen. So we began in mid-2016. A year later, and Jennifer Clark is the medical director. She said, we're going to screen everybody. We're going to start the most effective treatment that we have, and we're going to make sure they connect to treatment on the outside. She did that, within a year, we showed a 60% drop in overdose deaths
and people being released from incarceration. And I was just going to end with a few things that jumped out at me that I was a bit surprised. First, most people say, yes, I want that treatment when offered. Second, most people have a preference. They know what they want. They want either methadone or buprenorphine. Very few chose diponaltrexone. And I would say the most critical thing is connecting people to treatment in the community. If you don't have treatment to connect people to, you're not doing any favors by starting a treatment program in corrections. So I think we've shown that this is doable, but our major investment in this problem of opioid use disorder, it remains in the criminal justice system, and we really need to change that and invest in treatment and get people out of the criminal justice system. And I would finally just say that we should really examine closely the Portugal model, where they have diverted people from the criminal justice system into treatment. Thank you.
That was Professor Josiah Rich, MD, MPH. He's a professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University, and he was speaking at a public workshop on opioid treatment that was held by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. You know, semantics. This was a workshop on medication-assisted treatment. Now, a quite convincing argument can be made that any medical treatment that involves the use of medication is, by definition, medication-assisted treatment. It's odd that we've chosen to only apply that phrase to the use of opioid agonists like methadone or buprenorphine in treating substance use disorders. Possibly it's because the medication is seen only as part of the overall treatment, which would involve possibly counseling and lifestyle changes, maybe even acupuncture. But that still wouldn't really make sense. And there are a lot of health conditions for which counseling is part of treatment. And as to lifestyle changes, well, exercise and diet are essential for treating a number of conditions. Type 2 diabetes is a great example. According to the Mayo Clinic, quote, management of type 2 diabetes includes weight loss, healthy eating, regular exercise, possibly diabetes medication or insulin therapy, and blood sugar monitoring, end quote. Yet, when someone who has diabetes is using insulin to treat it, we don't refer to it as medication-assisted treatment. I mean, the phrase just makes little sense. I think it's just a fig leaf for people who are afraid of offending any drug warriors out there who are opposed to substitution treatment. Well, here's a hint. Those people don't care about the name you use. They're opposed to the treatment, not to the label. Trying to hide behind semantics doesn't work. I mean, it can even backfire. I prefer the term opioid substitution treatment because, well, that's what it is. That's what distinguishes this type of substance use disorder treatment from others. People who have a substance use disorder involving an opioid are regularly given an opioid of known purity and potency within a healthcare setting. The goal is for the person to be able to maintain so that they can integrate into the broader society and the underlying factors that drive their substance use can be addressed. In the U.S., this opioid substitution treatment involves the use of methadone or buprenorphine. In some countries, for example Switzerland, and to a lesser extent Canada, substitution treatment may involve the use of injectable diacetylmorphine, otherwise known as heroin. Heroin maintenance treatment, heroin-assisted treatment, again, several euphemisms to refer to the practice of helping people who have an opioid addiction and who inject heroin to be able to maintain and live a normal life, and not involve themselves in criminal activity. Rather than have me explain this, let's hear from another of the presenters at this National Academies workshop. And I'll apologize ahead of time for mispronouncing her name. Apparently, no one at that workshop could pronounce her name correctly. Dr. Eugenia Oviedo-Yux obtained her degree in clinical psychology at the University of Cordoba in Argentina, a PhD in social psychology and behavioral sciences methodology in Spain, and did postdoctoral studies at the Andalusian School of Public Health. In addition to her affiliation with the Center for Health Evaluation and Outcome Sciences in Vancouver, British Columbia, she's an associate professor in the University of British Columbia School of Population and Public Health and a Michael Smith Foundation for Health research scholar.
Good afternoon. My name is Eugenia Vidoyukes, and I think I'm the only one that can pronounce it, so I'm going to say it myself. Thank you very much for inviting me. Can I? Do I reach in? Oh, okay. Yeah, no, it's okay. I guess I'm too tall or too low for this. Thank you so much for inviting me or us. Everywhere I go, I present the research of the team. So if I say please remember, there is a huge team of 15 years of doing research in Vancouver, University of British Columbia. In the 1980s, a huge epidemic of HIV flood Europe, as one of the responses they had was to be able to reach almost 80% of the people that were using drugs by injection with long-acting oral opioids, mostly methadone, but in countries like France was buprenorphine. Then in the 90s, rich countries like Switzerland were still being hit by another heroin epidemic, and even when they are having safe injection sites, methadone, and many resources available to them, they were still very beautiful and lovable young people injecting in the streets. And they decided that if that was the medication that they were using in the street, they would open sites for them to provide them a safe, medically prescribed, pharmaceutical-grade heroin. It's called diacetylmorphine. So that was in the early 90s. Since then, many countries, including the U.S., has been trying to prescribe diacetylmorphine. And some countries follow, including Canada. And today, in Canada, we are able to prescribe pharmaceutical-grade heroin, diacetylmorphine. And in a second clinical trial, we are prescribing what another injectable short-acting opioid that is, you may know it as Dilaudid, that is hydromorphone. So today, in Canada, we have several options for people that cannot stop or do not want to stop using street opioids. We have methadone, we have buprenorphine plus Suboxone, and we have slow-release oral morphine, and we have hydromorphone, and in certain places you can access with a bit of help from Health Canada, diacetylmorphine. So I have been involved in too many clinical trials trying to bring these medications and bring evidence. We have been well published, and I say that just to make sure you know we have the evidence to back us up. And what we have learned is once we see the patients in our clinics, because of the nature of the medications we provide, we see the patients at the very far end of the continuum of care. Means those patients that by the time we see them, they have been injected in the street for 20 years. If there is something we see is the patients have failed nothing, it's the system that's failed the patients. We see many training opportunities for the system on how we should care the patients for. We learn to listen to the patients. 30% of our population that reach this treatment are from an indigenous community, when actually only 5% of our population is indigenous. So we learn that we are over-stigmatizing our indigenous folks. We learn how the cultural genocide translates to the people that are using street drugs. So we learned that we need to include in our curriculum culturally safe ways to treat. And culturally safe means that we need to look who we are, the ones we provide treatment, not so much to why is the people that is coming, because people don't feel safe when they come to our offices because we are very different and we don't treat them in the way that they would like to be treated. Because 50 years ago, we used to lock them when they had tuberculosis. And take them away from their families for years. So yeah, there is a precedent for why they probably don't come to treatment. We learned that probably between 30 and 90% of the people we reach, they have childhood traumas, physical and sexual abuse and neglect. We know that emotional neglect causes almost the same amount of damage in long term on how you build relationships with people and how you care about yourself than physical abuse. And we have 90% of our folks present to treatment with childhood abuse and neglect. So we learn that we have to include trauma-informed care, because we need to learn how we are and how we relate to our folks. And also we learn the shared patient decision-making when we allow physicians to have 5 medications they can choose from, and the patients feel less stigma. We have talked about stigma, how stigma looks like for our folks. When they come to our clinic, they have 5 medications they can discuss with their physicians. We're talking about ideal training, because we have a very small island of luxury today in a few clinics in Canada where we can practice how this will look like if you will able to have more options that are all of them evidence-based, with several randomized clinical trials, double-blind, published New England JAMA Psychiatry, British Medical Journal. It will look like when you come, the patients feel like they are not judged on what medication the physician will, as we heard today, very wise and compassionate people saying, we will want the patients to take the medication that we were trained and know might be the best for them, but we don't want them to leave without medications taken, because we know that if there is no medications, most likely, they're not going to do well. People come because of the injectable short-acting medication, but nothing else we do is about the medications. It's about caring for people. So when we are trying to talk about training, we talk about training a full spectrum of patients' needs and meeting people where they're at. Sometimes, from the healthcare system, we are really, really, really far to understand what people need, because we have not been trained for. And I heard very interesting and beautiful ideas. Yes, students are now today in a very social justice mind, and they want to know. You know, they want to be part of this. So if there is something we can share from a very wild idea of providing injectable short-acting medications to patients, is it allows an idea of ideal way of negotiating a better care for our patients.
That was Professor Yohania Oviedo-Yokes, PhD, with the University of British Columbia School of Population and Public Health and the Center for Health Evaluation and Outcome Sciences. She was speaking at a public workshop on opioid substitution treatment held by the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. And that's all the time we have for this week. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.